And
Well, okay.
where do we want to go next with this forgiveness worksheet process? As I said, I think this is day six that we've had this conversation, and we're what, up to step five now, I think. Yeah, we're on step five.
We're on step five.
Yeah, hey man, we're almost halfway through.
That.
It will take another 6 days.
I know you
days.
Mentioned that. Earlier, 6 days, it really seems like just a few. It's been such a wonderful journey. To start off today, my notes tell me about every goal I set creates stress. And I
yes.
think we left off there. And
right.
if I'm
I remember
remembering
now.
Correctly, that we have to have some stress for every goal or we wouldn't accomplish anything. And if you could just bring that around to the bad side of stress so I could
sure.
have a clarification on that, please.
Well, actually, I'll bring it around to the good side of stress. Without stress, you're dead.
Okay.
Without mm-hmm. stress, all behavior is based in stress. Without stress, you know, let's say the stress of thirst, you wouldn't drink, you'd dehydrate and you blow away. If you sat on the tack and you didn't have the stress of wanting your butt to be comfortable, you'd sit on the tack till you probably got an infection. The infection would spread throughout the body and one would die. You know, stress is an absolute requirement. You don't want a stress-free life. You don't want to live in a stress-free world. And there's no such thing as a stress, an environment that stresses us. What creates stress is the goals that we hold. And that's why so many people can be in a given circumstance, and because of the goals they hold, the perceptual constructs of their minds are so different that you can't even imagine they were at the same event. You know, go into a courtroom and listen to six different people testify about an accident, and you wonder if any two were at the same accident. You know, there's the guy who, you know, is a you know, has a prejudice against women drivers, and he swears when he saw the accident happen that there was a red light and this woman drove through it and, you know, smashed into this other guy. And the fact is, the actuality is that it was the guy who drove through the red light. The woman was perfectly in the right. But his brain, with his prejudice, twists his perception and shows him that, oh, well, that's the problem, that's the problem, that's the problem. And everybody's reality is unique and different. Now, a really good line to write down, and this is a quote I'll invite everybody to look up in the New Testament. And again, this isn't about religion. Here's Yeshua, the master psychologist now. We're not listening to physicists now, we're listening to psychologists. And he says this, sufficient for the day are the evils thereof. Now, there are two different, that like you look at that statement and you go, what the heck does that mean? That doesn't make any sense if you get through the Greek translation of those words. But if you go back to the Aramaic, what Yeshua is saying is, if you want all the resources available in your mind to be at peak performance for everything that you face and have to do, then you don't want any more stress than leads you to do behaviors that you can complete today, sufficient for the day. And the word evil there is another archery term. You know, oftentimes the Aramaic idea of sin comes through the Greek. Many people say, yeah, it means off the mark. And it's an archery term. When you fire at the target, if you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled, sin, you're off the mark. That's all it means. It's not some big, evil, awful target. It just means if you put an energy in that's off the mark to your structure is going to suffer. You're going to have diseases. And ultimately, if you don't remove it, if you don't forgive it, you're going to die. Just, you know, wages of sin is death. It's physiology. And understanding the fact that if you overload your mind with stress, your resources are not going to be available. In fact, your mind is going to collapse and you're going to be in trouble. Now, So in the same way the word sin is an archery term, so is the word evil there. And there are two different translations for the word evil in Aramaic. So the first one is, you know, you miss the bullseye, that sin. If you miss the target altogether, that's evil. Like, you're totally off target. Like, you're not even, you know, near the target. That's evil. There's a second translation, however, of the word evil. And we talked about that in the Aramaicisms text. And that is, it means unripe or incomplete. So I think Dale used the example of a banana. So if I have a green banana, in Aramaic, that banana is evil. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the banana. It's just not right. If the banana comes into this nice, you know, lightly speckled form and, oh, it's ripe, it's now ready to eat. But if I let it go beyond that and it turns brown and mushy, it's evil again. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with it. It's good compost. Actually, if you freeze it, it makes great ice cream. But it's evil. So what Yesh is saying when he says sufficient for the day are the evils thereof is, if you load any more goals into your mind, each one creating a stress, that reach beyond the next waking period, you'll use so many resources in your mind that your mind will collapse and not be smart or useful. And you can use an analogy of a computer. We could say, sufficient for the day are the programs you have open on your computer. Now, if I open my computer and I open my word processor, I'm zipping right along. I can open my word processor and my email program. I'm zipping right along. I can open my CAD program. I'm zipping right along. I open my picture editing program. And all of a sudden, things start to slow down. I want to take that picture, and I want to turn it into a CAD. And I open my CAD program, and what happens? My computer collapses. All the resources are opened up by so many programs running. Sufficient for the day are the evils thereof. What he's saying in Aramaic is, if you load goals for tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day, you'll use so much of your resources up that you'll literally freeze. You won't even be able to take action. And the action you do take will be based in insufficiency because you don't have the resources to properly process and handle what's going on. He's telling people how to operate their minds. This is psychology that, you know, the psychological world doesn't even have a clue about. You know, they talk about stress is the bad guy. Stress is, there's nothing wrong. Stress is your best friend. You could not live without it. But, like anything else, if you overload it, things crash. Not going to work. This is the genius of Yeshua from 2,000 years ago, and it hasn't been discovered yet. They think this was about, you know, whether a lot of people think it was some old fogies in the desert that were didn't know what they were talking about, or other people think it's about religion. Rather than, here's where we live. You want your life to work? Understand that if you put goals into your mind for tomorrow, you're wasting resources, and you do too much of that, and your life gets into trouble.
That was a wonderful explanation. So easy to really relate with that, with our current computers, and I can certainly resonate it. That's an issue I have to deal with, for sure.
80 to 90% of people who end up in medical doctors' offices, their complaint is stress, and they don't even know they're doing it to themselves because nobody's ever taught them how they create stress. I've gone and I've listened to some of the best stress experts in the world. I have never found one who can tell me what it is that causes stress. What causes stress? Set a goal. You set a goal. You call the mind through resonance into activity. If your goal resonates things based in hostility or fear, then you're going to block rock. You're going to close the gateway that lets human life and love into your form. You're going to create goals based on raw materials, based on intentions that are either negative or destructive. And the mind's in trouble. So if you have rock and set, then love is present. The only intentions you can access through the frontal lobes of your brain with rock and set are those that are based in love. Those based in fear and hostility are blocked. Goals, or pardon me, intentions are the raw material of goals. You know, we talked about this before. They used to say, still do, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You can have all the intentions you want in the world, all the wonderful intentions, but if you never commit to them, frame them and set them as goals, then they don't do anything. They're useless.
Mm-hmm.
And so intentions from the frontal lobes of the brain are the raw material of goals. If your goals are based in Rachma, in love, then your perception is going to be based in love, and that's how you're going to get the highest and best evidence out of your mind. Now, that's the psychology that the world could use today. But it's unknown. And, you know, if Yeshua sat in most churches and listened to what they said, they'd say, that's all Greek to me. Because it's gone off into some realm of, you know, what do we got, 32,000 sects of Christianity?
Mm-hmm.
Point one of them out that can tell me how they understand that Yeshua is teaching how to manage your mind and your stresses. I've never seen or heard it. It's all Greek. So, understanding that, then you realize why the pivot point on this worksheet is in step three, where you identify your goal. That's the pivot point. That's the key, because that's what causes the mind to generate literally the perceptual construct that we think we see with our eyes, but is really just generated by our brain and seen in our brain. We see nothing with our eyes. Our eyes just receive information, and based on what that information resonates and the goal's active, the mind literally generates the world we see. And it takes about something like 7/10,000ths of a second. You know, the mind's always that something, I think that was the number that the scientists came up with, 7/10,000ths of a second behind what actually happened in the world. And, you know, if you're 7/10,000ths of a second behind what actually happened, you're obviously living in the past. Yeshua would say to you, let the dead bury the dead, the blind lead the blind. Cancel the goal, and here's where step five, now that we've identified the goal, now that we've got love present, cancel the goal, especially where there is hostility or fear at the root of the perceptual output of the mind, and that perception collapses in on itself. And when it collapses in on itself, it creates, we could almost imagine, it creates a pathway into the unconscious part of the mind. It opens a gateway to the unconscious. It opens the veil of the temple. We get to drop in the unconscious part of the mind and bring that which a moment ago was unconscious forward in the presence of active present love. And if there's anything corrupt, thinking in terms of computers, if there's anything in the mind that's being recruited into activity by this goal that is corrupted, when it's exposed to love, it heals instantly. And that's where forgiveness actually occurs, is when that corrupt data is exposed to love. And I'll just say from, you know, 40-some years of guiding people through worksheets, it still absolutely amazes me when people cancel a goal, what they drop into. I mean, the vast array of things that people drop into when they cancel a goal is just amazing. And then when I consciously, purposely, persistently, consistently cancel the goals that cause my mind to use corrupt data, I'm cleaning up the corrupt data in my mind. Then, when I get all the corrupt data in my mind and in my genes from my generations cleaned up, I have a mind that is filled with truth. It only shows me truth, accurate information about the actuality. It's still 7/10,000ths of a second behind actuality, but at least everything I'm being shown about actuality is true. And that's a stepping stone into what we call enlightened perception, where instead of going to carbon-based memory for the data, That's just that step behind actuality. We can go to actuality and receive directly information, insight, intuition about what's actually happening in the world. And then we have a listening ear for what the Aramaic descriptor was, Ruka Dukudja. If you look down at the bottom of the definitions, Ruka Dukudja is a feminine elemental force in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. When I cancel the goal, and you'll note in steps 5B, 5A is where I cancel the goal. 5B, 5A is where I review the whole workshop and cancel my goal. 5B is where I invite that, what we could even call the super processor, into activity in me. It's like, you know, I got 1,000 generations of who knows what kind of garbage. Geez, you know, I was doing some research on my genealogy, and, you know, I found out that my great-great-great-great-grandfather was in Napoleon's army that went to Russia and froze to death on the way back after suffering for weeks of deprivation and starvation. Yeah, that's in my genes. There's some corrupt data there, man. Oh, and then what happened to, you know, my great-great-great-great-grandfather's wife, as she found that out, and the children, and, you know, I mean, that terror, that trauma, that fear, that hatred, you know, how do I clean that up? How do I ever figure that out? You can't figure it out. But whatever the perceptions, the pained perceptions are based on, 100% of the time you can forgive it and remove the distortions of corrupt data. And everything based in hostility or fear that the mind serves up is corrupt data. In computer terms, it's just not true. It's not accurate. Mm-hmm. I don't have to know any more about a situation, an actuality, than to recognize that my mind is using hostility or fear to produce its perception. And now I don't have to even think about what's going on outside of me. I'm using corrupt data. I don't need to know anymore. I need to clean this up before I do anything.
And then we clean that up. Yes, and when becoming more and more clear. But when we clean that up, we're now cleaning up just the present, not just last year. This is all the way back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You'll watch people and you'll have memories of things that you have no way of knowing ever happened in your bloodline. And I've seen enough situations where someone had that sort of thing occur and they were able to go back and speak to someone who was there, who knew, and their perception, their recall, what surfaced in them, what they dropped into was accurate. And I've watched for decades now as people do one pivotal worksheet in their lives and everything changes. Now, sometimes they might have to do 77 times 70 worksheets to get to that one pivotal one. When that one's done, bang, everything shifts.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask you, and you answered that point. It's not going to very likely be in the first few one does. It's going to be down the line a bit when that pivotal one comes.
Well, what you remind me of, back about 15 years ago, I was approached by a man who was a fundamentalist preacher, and he was asking if he could use a page from the Kabor. He was looking for permission to use a page from the Kabor's manuscript for a cover of a book that he was writing. And he had been I don't remember how long now, this is years ago, but for many years he'd been a preacher, and he had a breakdown. And his breakdown was so profound that, like, his favorite thing was the Bible. And for a year, he could not even pick it up. He could not look at it. He could not read it. He was just in trauma. And after about a year, he was able to pick it up and start reading again. And the way he said it to me, when he was asking, he's writing a book for preachers, the way he said it to me is, when I picked the book up again, all it spoke to me about was love. Everything I'd done all the decades before meant nothing. All I could see was this book is about love. This is about how to be restored to love. It's like, yep, that's it. But, you know, if you don't have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, it doesn't make any sense. And if the eyes and ears we have are based in hostility and fear, rage and guilt and grief and pain and drama and trauma and blame, then, you know, we'll pick up that book and we'll see guilt and blame and fear and drama and trauma and, you know, have somebody to rage at. But not because the book's got anything to do with that. It's because the content that we bring to the book. We don't read the book. We read the content of our minds. And so until the mind is back on track, you know, when they asked Yeshua what's most important in the law, and the word law is not the rule of a superior, as the Greeks would have us believe, the word law means the way it works. So you're talking about having being human. How does it work? What's most important to make it work? He says, you've got to have Rachma. When you think of the Creator, when your mind forms a perceptual construct about the Creator, if it comes from love, hey, you're on track. When the mind forms a perceptual construct about your neighbor, then if love is the active presence fuel for your mind, then you'll have an accurate perception of your neighbor. If love is the active energy in you, when you think of self, then you're going to start to experience yourself as love, as who you are. And then he says, upon this hangs the law and all the prophets. In other words, you can't pick that book up and read one true word if you don't have active present love in your mind. People read it, and, you know, why are there 32,000 different sects reading that book? Because everybody's reading a different book. Everybody's reading what their mind projects into the words. They're not reading the words. Until you get that condition that he gave, Rachma, for the Creator, for neighbor, for self. It wasn't love God, love neighbor as yourself. You know, if there's any problem in the world, it's that most people are loving God and their neighbor as themselves, and most people have been trained that they're broken and live in self-hate, self-degradation, self-deprecation. So they are, quote-unquote, loving their neighbors as themselves in that sense. But once you get that condition as the prime directive, which is what he said it was, then you get to read the book truly. And all of a sudden, it's like a whole different, you know, one of my favorite examples of that is, you know, we hear all the time people say, when somebody gets vicious, people say, well, even Moses said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Even Moses said that was okay. It's like, well, that is one way, that's his one construct around that idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But what you'll find is if you take a mind that's keyed to love to that book and you read that section in those passages, what you hear is, and what you see is, Moses lived in a culture that was vicious and vile. People were just vile with each other. I mean, you know, there's one particular case that I often use as an example, and there's this, you know, son of a leader of a tribe of non-Jews that meets this Jewish girl who's the son of one of the tribal leaders, and they get playing footsie together, and oh my God, you know. So the son goes to the father and says, the girl, and says, you know, well, I truly, dearly love your daughter, and I'll marry her, and I'll do anything you want to make up for this, because I had sex with your daughter. And the father says, okay, well, let me speak to your father and see if I can get his agreement. I want your whole tribe to become Jews. You have to become circumcised to become Jews. If you do that, then it's all good with me. Remember this story?
Yes.
And, of course, if you're going to become a Jew, you've got to be circumcised. Mm-hmm. How good do you suppose men aren't fighting once they've been circumcised? And what did the father of the girl do? He went in and slaughtered the whole village, the whole tribe.
Took them all out.
So Moses was saying, okay, guys, if you got to take vengeance, the most you can do is what they did to you. You know, an eye for an eye, okay, if you got to do it, do it. He was putting a limit on vengeance. He wasn't giving permission, but a mind based in hostility or fear goes, ah, see, I have permission to do what I want to do anyway. And that's the way it is with most of the teachings that are there. You listen to people whose language is based in hostility or fear, and they find justification for everything they want to do. Because they're not reading the book, they're reading the perceptual constructs in their minds that they put into the book. And that's why Yeshua said, here's the principle upon which understanding that book properly hangs. It is rachma for the creator, for neighbor, for self. It all hangs on that. If you don't have that, you're reading your own book, you got your own religion, you're going off doing your own thing. That's why we don't have a religion here. We just have tools. Nothing to believe. Don't believe a word I say here. Take the tools, watch what happens. The tools work, your life will change. It's not about some kind of dogma or doctrine. It's just here. You'll start living as a human being.
What a beautiful thought.
If you watch that movie, if you watch that film, you'll see so many cases where you can just say, oh, my God, if you had just canceled that goal. Oh, my, like all the way through the film, you can just see it's goal after goal after goal driving people's lives. No human life there. Desire, longing, especially sexual longing.
Amazing.
It is. Mm-hmm. And you can't squeeze that out of the Greek. I don't care how hard you squeeze. You just can't squeeze
it's
it out of there.
It's not going to happen.
There are so many, I mean, the word rachma, there is no such concept. There is no idea, no word that even comes close to representing in English, in Latin, or in Greek, the word rachma. There's no such concept. And when you realize what Yeshua said, the importance of that is the whole of the scriptures and your life resides on that. Well, if we don't have even a concept of it, how are we going to get there? And then, of course, there's that passage we've spoken about before when Yeshua tells the group of people, you know, they ask the question, the group of disciples, what do we need to do to keep God happy? Like, you know, what's the game? What's the game plan here? And he tells them, and half of his audience turned in disgust, said too hard a saying, and they left and never came back. You want me to go into my own mind, body, generations, hate, fear, rage, guilt, grief, take responsibility for it and forgive it? Too hard a saying. I'm out of here. And then Yeshua turns to Peter and says, hey, you guys can leave too? It's a question of the ages, and most people are kind of in the mindset of, well, I got $5 in 5 minutes, tell me everything you know. And by the way, make sure it sounds like what I already think is true.
I like the disclaimer.
Yeah. I mean, if it weren't so sad, if it weren't that all of the suffering in the world today, and I'm talking about the people who are starving in different places in the world, the war, the murder, the divorce, the conflict, the families' breakups, all of that is a result of one single thing, and that is people do not know how or are unwilling to forgive what's in their structures. And the word forgive there means remove, not let off the hook. That's been the greatest con job ever done, to turn forgiveness into, of course, it's your fault I have this pain, and I'll be big about it. I'll forgive you. I'll let you off the hook for what's going on inside of me. Of course, I can let you and everybody else in the world off the hook for what's going on inside of me. It's done nothing to change what's going on inside of me. I'm not one step closer to Brahma. I'm not one step closer to living as a human being.
And that is why, like you mentioned about the film, that we have such a longing. We don't know.
I mean, generations of, I mean, stop and think about, you know, just look at your life and the unrequited desires of your life. Look at your siblings, your parents, your grandparents, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins. And then multiply that by, you know, in just, you know how many people there are in 30 generations of your bloodline and mine?
I think I heard you say like a, was it a billion?
About 1.6 billion if you do the math.
1.6 billion. Wow. And it's just like that's
what
just
kind
like
of unrequited, what kind of unrequited desire is there in the one point? I mean, considering, you know, just read a little history of the world. Mm-hmm. What do you suppose hasn't been resolved? And are we willing to take it on and resolve it? The generations, what did they say about the Jews wandering in the desert for 40 years? To get out of the desert into the promised land, what had to happen? The old generation had to die off. Not everybody in old physical bodies, but the root of the word generation is genari. It means cause. All of the causes held in the mind from the generations has to go. Otherwise, we live in the desert. We live in a state of unconsciousness. Not about a hot, sandy place. That's 35 square miles for 40 years. You look at that, you know, they talk about it. Without a parable, he did not speak to them. And clearly the creator says, this is allegory. I'm trying to get something across to you that your rational mind can't understand. You try and take it literally, and you destroy everything.
$1.6 billion people.
Unresolved desires.
Unresolved.
How many thousands of years?
A while.
Well, here's the beauty of it, though. You see, there's a super processor in you that when you're aware of her, will go to work with you and for you. And to the degree that you're willing to process through it, can move mountains in an instant.
That would be a lot quicker than it would take me to count 1.6 billion.
That's right. You got it.
That's just amazing when we think about it. We don't want to think too hard.
Yeah. You know, just think about a simple situation where you know somebody who was conceived, and before they were born, father died. And the people around, the family around, and the neighbors around watched this young man grow. And what do they say about him? God, he looks, he stands just like his father. God, he has the, I mean, that expression, see that expression on his face? That's just what his dad used to do. Wow, do you see that rage? That's the rage his father had. How did that happen? The self that's based in all of that, Yeshua said, it had to die for us to live. The false self, based in generations and generations of unrequited desire, faced and removed. And the self that flows from that, the false projected self from the past, the self that is perceived, has to be dissolved. That's what this work is about. That ultimately is what this work is about. We're asking people to develop the skill and the willingness and the ability to literally reach into their own cellular structure and remove the neuropeptides, the molecules of thought that produce the chemistry in their cells, and by so doing, remove the cause of their diseases as well.
You know, we're told the issues are in our tissues, but as you explain this, it goes all the way down to the cell level.
All the way down to the genetic level, exactly.
Genetic level.
Ultimately, that's what needs to be faced. And so developing the sensibility and sensitivity to be in that level of awareness. And the number one drug in our culture that keeps people out of that is busyness. Several years ago, Jeannie and I spoke at a maximum security prison in Ionia, Michigan. It's a prison that's in a former Civil War camp, and they actually gather all of the worst problem prisoners from the whole state of Michigan and take them to that prison in Ionia. The average person's sentence is 25 years to life. We went in and spoke there and did a forgiveness workshop and got a fabulous response and a whole lot of excitement. There were two people. Actually, one of them is the psychologist that sometimes does the show when Jeannie's not available, or, you know, does the switchboard while I speak and Jeannie's not available. Michelle Pache. She and another teacher from Lansing followed us, you know, followed us speaking there, and they did a series. And they were preparing, what we had set up was for them to do a Laws of Living intensive for the people who were part of that support group. And there was a requirement, the tradition has always been with Laws of Living in the prison system, that if people weren't responsible, they wouldn't do the work. So they had to pay for Laws of Living. But in this particular situation, people are there for 25 years to life. You know, they might get 25 cents an hour if they go work. You know, slavery is legal in the prison systems of America, so they might get 25 cents an hour if they go work in the commissary for a couple hours or something. But otherwise, these guys, it was a men's prison, these guys are locked in their cells 23 out of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the requirement, since, you know, nobody's got any money, but they have to invest in it to get value from it, the requirement was that they had to do 5 worksheets a day through the preliminary 8 weeks. You know, the excuse of every man who wanted to do the Laws of Living course, you know what the excuse was as to why they didn't have the 5 worksheets a day? While they were locked in their cells 23 out of 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Was it the same excuse that,
they were too busy.
The average person would have.
Too busy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Including.
Now, I know that's never happened for you or me, but.
Mm. We have to rethink busyness, don't we, as a people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have to rethink that.
No, we
that
all do.
That is amazing. So back to your thoughts on changing the genetics at the cell level. I want to ask this. I'm not quite sure I got it straight in my mind, but we hear of, well, we used to hear that our genes dictate our future, and we now know that that is not true.
Correct.
We have the term epigenetics, where we have a lot of influences on what we can do in our lives to direct our future health. So
right.
Would this work be considered epigenetics?
My take would be it would be considered epigenetic and genetic.
And genetic. I just had this. When you were explaining this a few moments ago, I just had that realization. That's another wow.
Everything from the generations is changeable. And if we're not dealing with, if we're not cognizant of what's in the genes, then we are literally trapped in the desert. And most people, if you notice, before people kind of start to scratch their heads and go, why is this happening to me again? I've been through this 87 different times with 42 different people, and I'm the only one that was every time. Maybe I'm involved in life. Before people ask that question, they're usually about 40.
Yeah.
Before they start to suspect that they're in the desert. And it's not all about everybody else. And then if you can help people to build the brain cells, you know, there's an old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But you can make them thirsty. You can build the brain cells so that people see the possible. To me, that's why we're doing this radio show. So that anybody that wants to see the possible can engage in something that they can go to every day and spend time building brain cells for something the world will not support in them. And once you got the brain cells, you can't unsee what's there.
Wow. And this work can and will, from what I'm hearing, it will turn genes on or off depending on what is needed.
Correct.
What is forgiven, and that if we're stuck in a physical problem, then this work will, we do this work in our minds, and we're going to change that gene.
Well, and ultimately, the thing that turns genes on and off is our thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that this work will turn them off. It's our thoughts. When we change that, you know, Paul talked about, be transformed by the renewing of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
When you bring your mind to correction and realize that instead of thinking your thinking with the generational patterns of the past, when you step into that other mind that's available to you, that mind that's totally, completely connected to love, and without doing step four in the worksheet, without having to, you know, tap into and bring conscious, active, present love, when you naturally live as conscious, active, present love, then anything that surfaces from your mind or your genes is automatically transformed. And that's where they talked about a new man, literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a
new
body.
And man is Adam, a new Adamos.
Adam.
We're going to transform the whole physiological device called a body-mind unit, carbon-based memory, when that mind is present in us and runs our lives. Rather than whatever fires in brain cells, you know, that 7/10,000 of a second delay that has us believing that something that comes from our past is actually happening in the present. And to recognize that when you, the reason they call the present is because whenever you're there, there's a gift. Everything is a gift. Every second, every instant. Listen to that story where the creator talks about, I have only good in mind for you. That's it. You're doing this other crap. And everybody wants to blame God. You know, you're looking. I listened to a guy who's supposed to be super scientific, intellectual genius, and just happened to come across a thing of his on YouTube. And he's somebody that, you know, almost everybody knows his name is physicist and scientist. And he's going over the reasons for the non-existence of God, and I have never heard a so-called scientist so, with so much hubris and so much ignorance about science in my life. I've never heard such a thing. And this guy is, I mean, he's literally, you turn on TV, you look at specials, he's on all of them. And the ignorance of science that he displays is just like boggles my mind. And he's top tier. I mean, he is very top tier scientist. Not going to mention any names, but you know, at the top of the pack. The hubris is just unbelievable. Yeah. But that's the mind of man. And when you recognize that the mind of man is not conceived, as they said, of what lies in store, what's possible, you've got to know how to collapse it. If you don't know how to collapse it, it'll run you.
The Creator has blessed us with a new body. We regenerate the cells every 7 years for
exactly.
a totally new body. But when we do this
Precisely.
Work, it's very, very quick.
Which leads you to the conclusion that you must be eternal.
Mm-hmm.
You must be.
Changes everything.
Everything.
This changes everything.
And many people, when you talk about eternal life, go, oh, yeah, well, spiritually, you know, my body's going to die, but spiritually. No, excuse me. Mm-hmm. That's not what the man said. He didn't say you have to die first.
Yeah.
He said eternal life. What do you have to do? What did he say? Look in Revelation. To he or she that overcomes, they will not taste of the second death. They will become a pillar in the temple of my God and shall go out no more. This is where we live. What's a pillar? It's a fixture. Go out no more means you won't kill another body. A fixture, a pillar in the temple. What's the temple? It's this body-mind unit. So, you know, with man, death began. We made the process of death up. Now, it's pretty deeply ingrained because everybody in your bloodline and my bloodline and everybody that I know that's over 110 is already dead. Everybody. So how deeply ingrained is it in your genes and mine? Join me in making a commitment to work through it and create support for working through all of that so that we actually together step into eternal life. That's my invitation to everybody that's listening. Actual, literal, physiological, permanent, eternal life. That's what we're here for. Now, of course, the trickster mind, the mind of man, will come up and say, yeah, that's it, I'm immortal. You got to watch your words. Yeshua says the power of life and death is in your words. People say, yeah, I'm immortal. What does the word immortal break down to? I'm mortal.
Mortal.
That thought will kill you. You don't want to be immortal.
Mm-hmm.
Immortal is focusing on what you don't want. And that's what the whole mind of man has done, is focused on what we don't want. And has a very, very poor track record at focusing on what we do. Oh, yeah, I want a wonderful relationship in my life. I don't want a person who will ever yell at me or scream at me or do this or do that. And all the things that people don't want, and they wonder why they get them as creators. Speak to the kid. Don't you ever talk to me like that again. What would instruction with a great deal of emotion just went into a child's mind when the father says, don't you ever talk to me like that again?
Mm.
A very direct command goes into the child's mind. Talk to me like that again, because the word don't doesn't mean anything in that equation. If I say, don't think about the color of your car, what resonates in brain cells? The color of your car.
The color of the car.
Don't talk to me like that resonates what in the child's mind? Talk to me like that. And what's the parent just modeled for the child, speaking exactly the way that they don't want the child to ever speak to them? And then they wonder why it happens. They wonder why it comes to bite them in the butt
mm-hmm.
with their own children. Forgiveness is the missing piece and the reason for all trauma and suffering in the world. If we had that, and people engage in it, we would process through all of that. And the whole world would be fed and housed and cared for, mm-hmm. and families would live as human beings. Cultures would live as human beings. Weapons would disappear. We wouldn't mm-hmm. need them. But for that one tool.
I'm sure you know also that there's several groups across the world that are working and actually some in operation. And I just have to think back now and wonder how many of them have this information.
Say that again. Tell me what you're referring to there again.
Several groups across the earth that are, I'm trying to think of the term, that they're starting communities that are moving towards living in cooperation with one another and not fighting each other, and no
right.
need for weapons, and no. coming together for community well-being. And
that's what you're in right there.
Mm-hmm.
in Theodosia. That's what you're in right there. You won't find a weapon on that property.
Yeah.
That's exactly the vision for Heartland. That's what we're, that's what it was bought for, and that's been the vision from day one. It's to create a space where the work can be done so that people can understand at depth what needs to be worked through and work through it. And we're coming down to where the phone's going to just cut us off in a few seconds, but we won't do the outro, just continue with the conversation. But that's been the whole vision from day one, from the first day of Heartland, was to do exactly that, create a community based in the heart, Heartland.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful.
So step five, A and B, all about forgiveness. And what's the next day you're going to be available to complete the conversation, to go to the next step?
It will be Thursday.
Perfect. Well, we'll play on Tuesday and Wednesday if you get a chance to listen in, and on Thursday we'll continue the conversation.